So I was thinking kind of today, wondering what I would talk about, that the only thing it may tend to talk about is coolness. And if I had great powers of eloquence, I would give a talk. I'd give a talk about that would evoke coolness in all of us. And but I don't have that ability. But there are a number of ways in which coolness is evoked through meditation practice. There are practices to evoke it, to feel cool, to make yourself feel cooler. As there are practices like, some of you know the Tibetan practice of tomo, where you kind of generate heat. The person sits in the snow and generates this heat and melts the snow around them. But it's also possible to do the reverse, and that is to create coolness and make your body really feel cool. And the usual way of doing this as a practice is to focus on that part of your body which feels coolest. And on a hot day like this, you might not find much. So I'd never done this before, really. But I thought I was going to mention to you, I tried now when I was sitting here. And for a while, I thought, well, where is it not cool? But then after a little while, I found that it was cool. There's a little bit of breeze or wind or something against the hairs of my upper arm here, right below the sleeve is of the shirt. And so I focused my attention there. And if you've developed your powers of concentration, and so you really need to have concentration in order to do this, then you hold your mind there. You make that your one-pointed focus of concentration on that coolness you feel there. And if you're very good at it, then everything else that you pay attention to begins to fall away. So things like the heat, the noises, the sounds, the itches, anything else, you start kind of receding from awareness as the mind kind of becomes absorbed in what it's focusing on. And so if you're focusing on coolness, then that's all that's really, if you're really good doing it well, that's all that's really left is this experience of coolness. And then at some point, as you're really locked into it, then the instructions are to spread that coolness around your body. You actually start manipulating and moving it around until your whole body feels cold. How much of this is happening literally and how much of this is happening in the imagination, it's hard to know. Probably a combination of both. But the effect is appreciated either way on a day like today. So that's one way that coolness is evoked. The more important way is that ancient India, not just ancient India, India itself, much of India, is quite a hot climate. And it can get quite a bit hotter than this. I was once in northern India in the month of June. And it was great to be in Bodh Gaya, the pilgrimage site where Buddha was enlightened. Because in June, there aren't any tourists there. Because no one in their right mind goes there. And so and people usually go in January, December, February, when it's the cool season. And so it was great because we had the whole Mahabodhi temple and the Bodhi tree where the Buddha was enlightened under, pretty much to ourselves. So you know, walk around freely and no crowds and very quiet, but it was intensely hot. So India is quite hot, and in this kind of in a hot climate, what's most appreciated is coolness, and coolness can seem very refreshing. And so, the vocabulary of spiritual attainment in Indian culture in Buddhist India was that of coolness, of being refreshed. And in many ways, that image was evoked in the spiritual teaching. And nirvana, the awakening experience, was often defined as a kind of coolness, attaining coolness. And there was a famous Thai teacher named Buddhadasa. And Buddhadasa would, his little encouragement to everyone, he came by, saw him, and maybe when the people were left, and he'd say goodbye, he would say, be cool. And I don't know, maybe he had no idea of the connotations in America for being cool. But some of us have tried very hard to be cool. Maybe some of you are still trying to be cool. And if you want to do it really well, you attain nirvana. That's the way to do it. And Ajahn Amaro kind of gave a similar teaching about this, the vocabulary, the usage of the word coolness coming from in Buddhism because of its Indian climate. And he pointed out, being English himself, that in England, which is not a cool, a hot climate, It's often cool, cold. It's often, you know, wet and cold. That there, the what's valued a lot, the kind of language of is the warmth of warmth. So, for example, you know, someone's warm-hearted. That's really a great thing. That's a warm, you know. So the idea of a personal warmth and so that kind of language tends to be valued. In India, it's more of the language of refreshing, being cool. That person's cool because the person is calm, is peaceful, not because the person is aloof. So the idea of coolness, being refreshed by the practice, being refreshed by the experience of awakening. And maybe some of you had the experience of being refreshed from meditation practice. Occasionally, I've had the experience of very dramatically feeling completely refreshed, like renewed, like completely reborn is probably much too strong of a language, but kind of it's quite a dramatic feeling, completely refreshed, made anew, purified, cleansed. And it's really a marvelous feeling to have that happen. Partly it's a function of concentration. Partly it's a function of wisdom, of insight that sees through things and allows the mind to be turned over or cleansed in a very radical way. The contrast to a cool mind or a cool heart in the Buddhist tradition is often the example of someone who's on fire with agitation. You know, we have that language in English also. Fever of desire, fever of passion. You know, hot head. And these kinds of things. And so the same thing in Buddhist India, the idea of someone who's filled with heat and fire. And the Buddha once gave this a sermon called the Fire Sermon. And in a book I once saw on the best speeches ever given in history of humanity, the Buddha's Fire Sermon was in it. And when I saw it in the Fire Sermon, I read it as if I kind of imagined maybe he was a great orator, Martin Luther King, or some really strong, and I imagined him giving this speech, you know, in a kind of very powerful way, not just kind of the way I would read it, which is kind of, you know, namby-pamby, you know, when I read. But it went, you know, he said, you know, the world's on fire. The eyes are on fire. The ears are on fire. The nose is on fire. The tongue is on fire. The body's on fire. The mind's on fire. The things we see are on fire. The things that we feel are on fire. The things we smell are on fire. The things we hear are on fire. The things we think are on fire. The world is on fire. And he goes on and on like this, the image of fire. It's on fire. And so, you know, what's he getting at? And then he says, it's on fire with it's burning with a fire of greed. It's burning with a fire of hate. It's burning with a fire of delusion. And so, their eyes, our ears, our nose, everything, are the vehicles that manifest or show the kind of fire that's in our hearts and our minds, fire of desire, of hate. And he offers the practice then to overcome that fire, to quench that fire, to put an end to that fire. And then experience this refreshing feeling of coolness of the mind, which is not inflamed by desire, by compulsion, by fear, by all the things that keeps the mind agitated. Sometimes this refreshing mind or heart of nirvana is likened to, is described with the adjective immobile, unmoving. And unmoving, maybe the best analogy is often sometimes a very still pool of water that's unmoving. You can see right to the bottom, completely, completely clear and fluid. Nothing, no agitation in it at all. And what you find then in Buddhism, a lot of use of water for describing spiritual attainment. As people get deeply into their meditation, it's sometimes the experience you have is likened to that of being in a cool, refreshing mountain, pond, lake. So imagine this hot weather, just laying there, kind of floating in this cool, refreshing water. And if you get deeper into the meditation, then it's described, it goes further, it's as if there's this upwelling of refreshing, cool water from the depths of the pond or the lake coming up and kind of enveloping you, and you feel this kind of saturated by this feeling of coolness that moves through your body. So it's being refreshed. Sometimes the analogy that's given is also with water, but a very different kind of sense, I think, is someone who is lost in the desert, and maybe dying of thirst, very, very thirsty. And then finally they see in the distance, they see a lake, fresh, clear water to drink. And the experience of seeing that clear water, their mind gets filled with joy and delight. Kind of in anticipation of being saved, anticipation of what it's going to be like. And they go to the lake and they drink their fill. And they sit down on the edge of the water and lay down and just lay there and relax and rest, having drunk their fill of the water. And then there's a very different kind of happiness that comes over the person. That's very different than the excitement of the anticipation, the joy of being saved, the joy of the water. And kind of now it's kind of very tranquil, peaceful happiness. Oh, it's been done. I can relax now and being very satisfied. So that's also a description sometimes of what happens in meditation practice. That at times in meditation, when the concentration is strong, there can be a feeling of this great kind of almost like anticipatory or exciting kind of happiness or joy, kind of a thrill. Partly it can be a thrill that maybe it's, if people never experienced this, it might be odd to point this out, but to hear this. But as the mind, as you get a sense, or as the mind gets a sense, that it can begin to concentrate on something. Not just simply kind of hold itself over a few seconds or a few minutes, but this magic of kind of being engaged, absorbed, maybe locked in is not too bad of a word, but kind of you feel at some point that the mind is kind of willing, happily, or engaged with the object of meditation, with the breath or whatever the focus is. At some point, if you never had this experience, maybe it sounds bizarre, but as we get more and more focused, then at some point the interest, the fascination, the impersonal fascination of the mind begins hooking on or engaging, or it's very hard, you know, easier and easier to stay there. It doesn't want to slip off very easily. It's like it wants to stay there. And so you get a sense of thrill. Oh yeah, I can stay there. My mind's not going to slip off. And so this thrill, this joy arises. It's likened like this person seeing the pond who's thirsty. And then as a person gets into it, and it's not just, you know, seeing the possibility and the excitement of making it work, then the person kind of, the mind kind of begins to actually rest there and stay there, and it feels really satisfied with being there. It's like the coolness of refreshing feeling after you've had your drink and laying there on the edge of the pond and being quite refreshed. Is it working? Am I refreshing you a little bit? Not that hot. Then there's a Zen approach to heat. And the Zen approach to heat or cold is when you're hot, you're hot. When you're cold, you're cold. And part of that is you don't resist it. You don't try to run away from it. You don't try to manipulate your experience to make it better. You let go of all the things that, all your judgments, all your resistance, all your aversion, all your desire, all your clinging, any kind of neurotic involvement with the experience that keeps you some separate from it or keeps you anxious about it, you let fall away. And just you and the heat. It isn't just you and the heat, because you're supposed to. You're one of the problems. So you're one of the things that kind of limits the experience. So you're supposed to drop yourself away. So it's just the heat. When you're hot, you're hot. When you're hot, just heat. And so part of the quest, and sometimes in Zen, is to let everything else fall away, except let the heat just be there, if you're hot. And then the heat's not a problem, if it's just heat. But if you experiencing the heat, and you then judging the heat, then you have problems, maybe. So you can have the Zen approach, or you can have the approach of finding coolness and developing that coolness in your body, or you can have the approach of going deep into concentration, deep into insight, and tasting the wonderful, sweet, refreshing winds of nirvana, of awakening. So that was just kind of not even my talk I was going to give. I had this whole talk prepared, which I could save for next week. I just kind of went on and on about coolness, thinking that might be nice today. And Would you like to ask questions or talk about coldness or something about what I said? Or would you like me to kind of venture forth on section A, B of the talk? What would you like to do? It's nice to have questions and hear from you and have it be more informal, and because we don't do it that often. And yes?
Is it normal to change your temperature as you're meditating?
I wouldn't say it's normal. Pretty much everything is normal in meditation. part of my job is to normalize everything for people. It's okay, you know. That happens to a lot of people. it's true, because there's a lot of you know, things happen to people. A whole wide range of things happen, and most of it's pretty normal. Occasionally there's something you have to be kind of work with more carefully, but a lot of it is just, you know. And one of the things that can happen is sometimes body temperature can change. For various reasons, some people get for various reasons their metabolism kind of quiets down, and they get cold really easily. And you see some meditators put on gloves and all kinds of stuff, and other people will find that the concentration itself sometimes brings on a lot of heat. And you see people sometimes it's really cold, and they start taking off their shirts and t-shirts and just sitting there. You know, everybody else looking at them. You know, who's this Viking there? But then the concentration begins to wane. And then they have to put their clothes back on again, because you know it's a function. So there's a lot of things that happen, a lot of changes, physiological changes that can happen through meditation. There's no wonder that meditation can have such a huge beneficial physiological effect on our body medically, because what we do with our mind has a big impact on our physiology. And that's just one little thing, changing your temperature. People say, it's quite well known that as people relax, generally people will get warmer in their fingers and their hands. And some people use that as a biofeedback response, with a focus on making their hands warmer, it helps them relax. So I've known some people that to report that their hands get warmer and tingly when they meditate. But there are other people who actually get colder through it, meditation, and they have to put on, And we're all different in so many different ways. Was that kind of addressing your question? You want to ask?
I noticed that I tend to get hot. I'm one of those.
Gil, when you said that a Zen approach would be, if you're hot, let everything drop away with the heat, or that sense, so that there's... But isn't that in some way what you also do with Vipassana?
Sure.
Essentially,
sure, it is.
No. If you want to develop concentration, then stay with that as long as you're capable. Maybe, I don't know. But I was curious how you distinguish between.
So the question, if you don't know if you could hear it, is that the Zen approach that I talked about, just when hot be hot, isn't that also a Vipassana approach? And I think the difference is that in Zen, there might be the practice to do that, just become one with the heat. In Vipassana, we're not practicing to become one with anything. We're practicing just to pay careful attention to what's actually happening in the moment. And if you're hot and you're paying attention, you'll notice your resistance to the heat or your aversion to the heat. If you notice that carefully, then the resistance tends to fall away, drop away. And when the resistance drops away, then you might talk about kind of being one with the experience, because But generally, we don't talk about being one with the experience in Vipassana. It's kind of a little bit heretical in the Vipassana scene to say you're one with anything. So there's no Vipassana jokes. Yes, please.
This list is thrill you were talking about. Is this not the Pali
Piti? Piti is the joy that comes up when you feel when the person sees the lake in the distance and is thirsty, and so kind of the excitement, the thrill. Piti is sometimes occasionally translated as thrill. Mm. And then the happiness when once you've drunk the water and you're laying on the side of the lake just relaxing, that's sukha. Did you have a question earlier? Here, someone here? Did you have one? I saw your hand earlier. Mm-hmm. No.
Oh, it's really very similar. Oh. I had observed that as your heart's lungs when you were sitting, Monastery.
Yeah. When I was at Tassajara, the Zen monastery, I actually got chilblains, which is, I didn't even know what chilblains were. And then I found out that this is something that tended to plague English housewives when they used to have central heating in England, because they would, because the apartments were kind of cold, and they would plunge their hands into the hot dishwashing water, and then they would go into the cold parts of the house. And what chilblains are is when, if you have kind of thin capillaries, and your hands go from being hot to being cold quickly, or being cold, I guess it's from cold to hot quickly is what it is, then your blood will suddenly rush into your capillaries, and your capillaries are constricted and can't handle it, and then they'll burst. And so your hands get kind of red, and they itch terribly. Oh. So Tassajara, it's very cold in the winter. There's no heating. They had this rice paper windows in the meditation hall. And we'd get down below freezing and stuff, and we'd be sitting there, you know, with rice paper windows. And back when I was there, and it's better now. But now they believe in heating the room up. But in the golden age of Zen, when I was there, there was no heat. And Tassajara is also famous for having these warm hot springs. And in the wintertime, it was one of the delicacies, was to go into the hot springs. But I couldn't go. I couldn't use the hot springs because of what it did for my chilblains. And I couldn't actually have my hands in the full sun in the wintertime. I'd have to keep them on my back when I was in the sun, because it was so cold that if it was in the sun or any kind of heat, and that I would start itching. So meditation would aggravate it, because I would be sitting in meditation very, very still, and I'd get really cold and be really still. The combination of being really still for an hour and a half and being really cold, and it made it really bad. And so after a while, I got a wool sock, and I cut off the end and made a muff from it. And then I went and got this in the sports shops. I got these little packages that you kind of open to the air, and they make heat. And I'd have it there in my mudra in my hand like this. Sorry about that digression. Other questions? Comments? Yes, Kate.
Why is it considered heretical about the being one?
Heretical is too strong a word. There's a lot of different experiences. There's a lot of different kinds of spiritual experiences people can have. And there are very profound experiences where a person does feel one with things, feels a unity of things. And I don't think that Buddha, you know, which is kind of our reference for our tradition, is particularly critical of those kinds of experiences. They have their place. Some of them are quite useful. But why I said it was heretical is that if you take those kinds of experiences to be the ultimate purpose of the practice, or you make some kind of metaphysical conclusion that of oneness, that our true nature is oneness with the universe, our true nature is oneness with nature, or something like that. That's what's a little bit heretical. You don't, you might have the experience of oneness, but you don't want to interpret that through metaphysics. So that means that I am one with nature, I'm one with the universe. But you also, the opposite is also heretical, to say you're separate. So the idea is you're not supposed to play that kind of game, where you're kind of saying who you are in relationship to anything. That this, the liberation the Buddha was talking about was not a, couldn't be formulated in a sense in a metaphysical statement based on who, an I or self, you know. So I saw another hand.
I was just wondering what you meant by the experience of being one with an experience. What that means.
I think probably there's a range of things a person might experience, but one is feeling non-separate, somehow, or very, very intimately connected to it. Sometimes when the mind is not preoccupied with its thoughts and concerns and fears and projections and, you know, self-obsessions and all that, and the mind, the awareness gets very soft and spacious, then it can be sometimes feel like the object you're paying attention to is right present for you, which is like, you know, you and it are not separate. It's like an extension of your hand almost. Or it feels like another way of experiencing it is that your awareness seems to go reach beyond the confines of your head. It seems like almost like what awareness is this big field, this bubble that kind of stretches out in front of you, around you, in all directions. And it, somehow everything that occurs happens within this bubble of, within this field that's you. Which, that's part of it. Another way of oneness is more retroactively, and that is that a person can feel so absorbed in what's happening that all sense of time, sense of self, sense of other, everything falls away except for that thing is all there is. And so that, for some people, they call that a oneness experience, because you become one with a thing. You become the thing. You don't feel any separate. So there's a range of things that people might a range of things that people might call becoming one with. And it happened a lot with people who took LSD back in those days. The experience of cosmic oneness. Yes.
So you said that this Vipassana center is different than other places in the country. What did you mean by that?
There's only one other Vipassana center, urban Vipassana center in the country. There are two, or there are several retreat centers where you go to be resident, to be on retreats. But in terms of being in the city, around where people, in a community meditation center connected to where people are, this is, there's only two, one in Cambridge and one here. And we're different than one in Cambridge. The one in Cambridge is, I'm not sure I want to characterize it, I don't know that much about it, but we're much more of a community center here than they are. Some people kind of, joke that we're more like a congregation here at IMC. But we're much more open. We do a lot, much wider range of things. We have teen programs. We have family programs. And our doors are open in a much more fluid way than some other places. And we're more connected, I think, in some ways. We are, in the community. And also, we run it differently than CIMC in Cambridge. We run it completely on a donation basis. So the doors are open to anybody to come in, and no one has to pay. That money is not meant to be a barrier to anybody coming. Whereas I think at CIMC, you're expected to pay something. And they have memberships there. You pay these $240 a year or something as a member. And it's more formal there. What I would like to try to have here is kind of informality, where it's relatively easy for people to come and go as they wish. And there aren't any formal barriers for that. I'm fond of the fact that the building has seven doors to the outside, external doors. And whereas most of the time, most of them are locked. Symbolically, I like the idea of the seven doors, because the idea is that we're open to the community at large quite freely. People can come and go. It's easy to come in. It's easy to leave. So something like that. So I have to thank you for asking, because that's the kind of things I'm supposed to talk about this interview. Yes?
You talked about becoming one with something.
Boy, this is a...
That's right. A dissertation time. Psychologists have tried to study this in states of absorption, and I think they've kind of concluded that around age 12, that ability becomes fairly stable. But do meditators have a different perspective, that this can be a skill that grows through practice, or do you find that adults going into it tend to have a fairly stable ability to become one with something?
I'm not sure how to answer the question. It is true that that ability can be developed through concentration and through self-awareness and learning how to let go of all these things that get in the way. So it can be developed. Some people have it happens accidentally. So, we don't know how it happened. It just somehow seemed to happen. Some people report it occasionally in lovemaking. There can be a feeling of great oneness with that person. And I remember once I was teaching a meditation class at Stanford, and this young Stanford undergraduate talked eloquently, on and on about how wonderful lovemaking was, because he felt a kind of oneness with the cosmos in making love with his girlfriend. And I asked him, how does your girlfriend feel about that then? she's probably there, hey, I'm over here. he's communing with cosmos. so there, you know, so and in terms of it being stable, I mean, it's either stable for reasons which are innate to who you are, that ability, or it's something that can be cultivated. Or some people will take drugs to do that. I don't recommend that. Do you have say something more? You said you're doing your dissertation on experience of oneness.
Well, it's on three things. It's on it's really on whether or not depression can be alleviated through meditation or hypnosis. But I'm also looking at states of absorption because that's very closely related to hypnosis. And we found that it does seem. I'll be killed by my boss for saying it. It does seem that meditation may have a fairly profound effect, but the results are very early. We haven't compared it with other state-of-the-art therapies to see could it do better or does it do worse. But in terms of absorption, there's this idea that absorption is related to hypnotizability. And I've been interested in how does it correlate with the improvement people make through meditation training in terms of their depression. And that's why the psychologists seem to believe that around puberty, that's it, it's stable. And there's some debate over it.
Or stable meaning it can't be developed anymore.
Yeah, pretty much. That sort of your ability to go into a very absorbed state is, if you can sometimes do it, that's all you'll be able to do most of your life. If you're someone who, be it making love or reading a book or watching a movie, you get totally absorbed, then that's the way you're going to be. It's more stable than IQ, or so they think. But they haven't really investigated how well can you train someone to be other than that. But then there's some debate.
You know, it's interesting, the Buddhist notion of the mind is that the mind is not a thing, it's an activity. So it's because it's an activity, it's malleable, it can be changed and developed. And one of the premises of Buddhism is that you can cultivate and develop the mind. And you don't have to settle for what you're born with or what happens when you're 12. And you can develop and cultivate great states. But there's a great range of how easy it is for people to develop concentration and how far a person can go and how much that has to do with personal qualities and all there's so many variables. But there certainly is difference in speed in which people get concentrated and how deep some people can go. But certainly it can be developed, and the mind can be changed that way, it's malleable. Yes?
Well, I was just going to throw in that another thing that can affect absorption and that kind of thing is rhythm. Yeah, rhythmic. Different sorts of rhythms can produce different sorts of states of absorption or trance and things like that. So I think that can have a lot of rhythm too. Because I think almost all music, like popular music, has some kind of a beat. And that's a lot, mostly what people lock into. And that's what really is mostly what makes the music grab people is the beat.
Yes.
Any parallels between anatta and oneness?
Parallels between.
Has there been any discussion? The state of anatta, the lack of the self. Without self, then there's the other.
Well, that's kind of a metaphysical step the Buddha doesn't want to go. And the Buddha was very precise and very careful how he talked about this anatta. And I think he was very careful not to call it a state of not-self. Or say you have an experience of not-self as a metaphysical thing. The way the Buddha talked about not-self in the suttas very carefully was mostly as a qualifier of other things. It was a characteristic. Anatta is a lakshana, it's a lakana, it's a characteristic. It's a characteristic of things, it's not a denial of things. So that the Buddha said form is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, formations are not self, consciousness is not self. So it's saying what's not self, as opposed to he doesn't want to then reify the not self experience, therefore there's a not self. And so it's a little bit hard then to make parallels with the experience of oneness. Though, you probably can. Mystical or spiritual experiences are, the descriptions of them are very difficult to correlate or compare or really to judge, because spiritual mystical experiences tend not to be described in heavy, you know, in precise technical detail. And more often they tend to be some slide over into a little more poetic descriptions. And so two people might say the same thing, and they might not quite understand each other, because they might have different references for the experience. So it's very tricky to talk about parallels, correlations between different models, different descriptions, because of it's hard to know what they really mean in their descriptions. So
how much
emptiness?
In terms of the self,
well, there are all kinds of, there's a whole range of, meditative experiences, spiritual experiences that a person can have. And some of, there's a whole range of things that people have called experiences of emptiness. And some people might, in an experience of emptiness, call it a sense of oneness. There's, they feel there's no self there. There's a lot, there's sounds and trees and bushes and all this. And so there's no self there. They might say, well, it's empty. It's very, it feels very empty. It feels like a great void in some sense. And because it's so vividly alive with the other things, you might say, well, it feels like oneness with those things. So, but I'm a little bit reluctant to go and kind of say yes, or, because there's so many different, it's like, you know, once you get into the world of spiritual experiences, it's like so much richer than our conventional reality that we live in, conventional states of mind. There's so many different things that we're, so I'd have to get in with you and actually see exactly what you're talking about and what you're, you know, what's going on. But with emptiness, that also is very clearly in most of the orthodox Mahayana tradition and also the Theravada tradition, is understood to be a characteristic of things. The Heart Sutra, for example, emptiness is a characteristic of things. It's not a denial of things. So it's always in qualifying. It's always qualifying something. A form is empty. It says form, you know. You know, so it's empty of, I mean, it's empty of what? What is the emptiness? The orthodox Mahayana is not using emptiness as a state. You find a lot of Mahayana teachers trying to knock their students off their states. You know, I experience great emptiness. You know, that's not the point. So it's a big topic. In other words, I mean, what you're saying is it's very interesting what you're asking about, but it's very hard for me to respond without laying the map out carefully.
Well, I just heard, I guess the quality of mind, I don't know the word, but the quality of mind is like an open sky, spacious, sort of, you know, overreaching.
Yeah, it's a great thing. So it's a great thing. So then the question is, so what? I mean, what's, you know, what is that? Is that the ultimate experience? Is that the final goal, is to have a great, spacious, all-encompassing mind? And then you have to look at the different Buddhist traditions. Different Buddhist traditions will validate or understand or place that experience different places along the map of all the different, you know, the spiritual experiences a person can have. And so it's one among many kind of spiritual experiences. And some people will take a more instrumental approach to that. So that has certain usefulness, that kind of experience. Let's use it for a certain purpose. Other people will say that there's no purpose for that experience beyond itself. And some people will say, don't stop that. That's, you know, that's good, but that's short of the goal. And so the teacher will try to pull the rug from underneath your spacious mind. So it's a whole, you know, it all depends on the tradition you're in and how it's understood. And so I can't give you anything to hold on to tonight. Yes?
When you mention, like, the coolness of this other thing that some of us experience, but nearly going into like a pain, or like you say, go into the pain,
yeah,
or go into a cramp, and whereas normally you fight it or you resist it, and it tends to make it dissipate. Or my wife can even, rather than coughing, she can, I guess, go into that and dispense the cough. I can't do that. But they sound a little different. If you liked what you were going into, or you wanted to absorb it and be there, and the other is maybe it's a lot of acceptance, and I don't know.
Yeah, there's different things that might happen when you bring attention to bear on an experience in your body. And with enough mindfulness and concentration together, often the experience is a person have something disappears. It falls away, it passes away as you're watching it. With pain, it can either happen because as we bring attention to it, it can relax. That part of your body disappears. Or it can be purely a function of the mind itself. And but I think when you're using concentration to make something grow or to stay like that, then you're doing it without a lot of insight. If you're trying to use a lot of insight, you're trying to see very clearly what that experience is, the nature of that experience. That's what causes sometimes the experience to begin to fade away or fall away. But if you're not trying so hard to study it, but just to simply fixate on it, that's when you can start manipulating and doing something with it. So you don't want to get too close then. Just kind of, you know. And it's used sometimes for pain. It can for some people be very helpful to focus on pain directly with mindfulness, and that's often what we teach. But sometimes when the pain is very severe, it's counterindicated to actually focus on the pain. Sometimes people will focus on anything else but the pain. But one technique is to actually find some place in your body. And this is done sometimes when people are racked with pain, like people who just terrible states of pain that they can't be helped medically. They'll focus on find something in their body that's pleasant, pleasurable. And it might be just a very small little piece of their inner thigh, you know, that feels a little bit. And then to focus, develop a concentration there, and when the concentration gets strong on that particular point of pleasure, then to begin expanding that pleasure throughout the body. And that's as an antidote then to being consumed or racked with that kind of pain. So, you know, there's a lot of things you can do with your mind. The mind is an amazing tool. It blows me away what the mind is capable of. The uninitiated, people who never actually worked with their mind or meditated in a consistent way, it's hard to imagine what your mind is capable of. But the mind is an activity, not a thing. And as an activity, it's actually made up of a series of many different activities. So how you use the different activities and how you bring them into balance and what you emphasize and what you de-emphasize affects a lot your experience of the mind and what you do with it. So generally, in our Vipassana tradition, the emphasis is don't tinker with your experience. Rather, just develop straightforward mindfulness of what's there and try to find how to be equanimous with what's there, not to be in conflict with what's there, not to try to make it better or worse or fix it or avoid it by making coolness arise or, you know, all these things, but just be completely honest, uncompromising honesty and directness about what's actually your experience moment by moment. That's kind of the strong point of our tradition, doing that. But there are, you know, in the tool bag of our tradition, a lot of other tools. And sometimes there are tools that involve intentionally changing your experience.
Question. I've been listening to Pema Chodron.
Yeah.
I really like her. Is she in the Vipassana tradition? Because basically what she was doing in these states is, you know, sitting and pay attention, watch your breathing, just returning your breath.
Yeah.
That
particular practice is pretty universal in Buddhism. A lot in the meditative traditions of Buddhism, meditating the breath and just letting everything go and just watch what arises is pretty universal. So we do that in our tradition. Zen tradition does it. She comes out of the Tibetan tradition, and we would like to adopt her. Yeah. Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's a whole thing, the history of Buddhism. But Buddhism evolved and developed quite a bit over the many centuries it was in India. And so, depending on the particular time that Buddhism went to different countries, like when it went to China and went to Tibet, it got a different stream of that development in India. And so the stream that we have that came through Sri Lanka and Burma and Thailand was a very early stream. Left India probably around the time of 200-300 years before the Common Era, so a long time ago, more than 2,000 years ago, and And after another almost 1,000 years of development in India, then Buddhism went to Tibet. So you had a lot of changes in that time. And then in Tibet, it developed a lot more. And in Indian Buddhism went to China before it went to Tibet. So, you know, around the year, between the years 300 and 500. So so depending on when it picked, you know, it took, you know, it received the Indian tradition, it differs. And the traditions are quite different. Differences can be, in some ways, as different as between Catholicism and Protestantism. And some people have actually likened the arising of the Mahayana and the Zen tradition, the Mahayana tradition, as kind of like similar to a great reformation of Buddhism that's radically different from the earlier tradition. And so there are big differences and there are big similarities. And
For someone who doesn't know about any of it, it's like,
yeah.
I love Buddhism because it's the very basic principles from the Buddha are so.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's often, and often a lot of the traditions share a lot of the basic principles. And for many of us in the West, not knowing about the Asian tradition, Buddhism just seems like Buddhism. And in fact, there's actually, I believe, there's greater variation within all the schools of Buddhism than there is between all the schools of Christianity. You take Eastern Orthodox to Mormons, and you know, there's a lot of variety. Okay, so be cool.